Big Finish presents Doctor Who, Time Lord Victorious, Short Trips, Lesser Evils by Simon Guerrier, read by John Coleshaw. Death descended on the planet Alexis, one bright and crisp, clear morning. The veiled woman slithered from her shuttlecraft, her bare purple tentacles damping down into pink and dew-fresh grass. The grass curled away from her touch, but too late. Just the briefest contact with her crystalline skin immediately condemned the whole species. The Katuru woman paused in the light of two suns to breathe in the cool air, softly scented with pollen and spores. Life was abundant on the planet Alexis. The woman had arrived here to see to that. The woman's heavy robes were threaded with gold, twin columns of symbols and sigils appropriated from worlds she had already judged. Each pictogram had its own native meaning. Prayers for mercy, or emblems of defiance and strength. But the woman had no interest in the intended significance. She simply appropriated shapes and textures from the worlds she trod. In doing so, the symbols took on a new meaning. They became memorials to the countless lives she had smited. She made her way forward. The grass, soft against her dry, purple skin, had been close-cropped by the placid, grazing creatures. A herd of them, each one a plump blob on six stocky legs, regarded the woman with idle curiosity. Not knowing to fear her, or the judgment she would soon pass on them, she reached out a hand, stroked the flank of one creature. It shivered at her touch, and what she took from the entire herd. Their species, she decided, could live for 8 of this planet's years, however long that might be. The creatures lowed mournfully as she left them to their now compacted lives, and continued on to the line of tall trees, the border of the great forest. Branches shifted and swayed in the breeze, as if to ward off her advance. The Katuru woman brushed slender, powerful fingers against the rough bark of the nearest tree. She tasted its steady metabolism, its feelings, and its fears, and granted its species long life. Then she was under the canopy of branches, her eyes adjusting quickly to the dappled light. It was noisier here than out in the open, and the forest floor positively teemed. Grubs and bugs of every shape and texture, crawling insects with 3 knees per leg, donut-shaped birds feasting indolently. The energy and noise of these myriad things coursed through her. They cricked and cawed, growled and hooted. Shouts for attention, cries of alarm, calls and responses that shared information. So much thriving, interwoven life. She moved among them with deliberation. Many were wary at first, coiling away from her tentacles, chattering, warning, or releasing pheromones to keep her away. But she exuded deathly calm. She did not pounce or chase or bite. She did not ensnare or eat them. The creatures had evolved to react to immediate danger and soon accepted her intrusion into their world. Some insects, with their curious, buzzing intelligence, even ventured close, eager to claim her as new territory. Some dared to land on the soft, dark fabric of her robes. She tolerated them patiently. then reached out her hands. The buzzing insects she gave a single day once they had developed from larvae. She didn't know how long a day lasted on Alexis, or how much day length might vary over the course of this planet's orbit round its middling star. It would suffice all the same. The insect she touched fell away from her, stunned, just for a moment. Then it and its siblings buzzed away, already on borrowed time. The Katuru now bent and placed her hands on top of the dense litter of the forest floor. The creatures of and in the ground were drawn to her warmth and power. They came to her voluntarily. She brushed the carapace of a tiny globular bug and constrained it to a lifespan of weeks. The worms beside it she allowed a year. A slug-like monstrosity she gave a decade, entirely on a whim. Did the creatures understand what she did to them? The smaller species had only a limited consciousness anyway. Yet, once touched, they buckled from the terrible loss. To anyone keen enough to hear it, the noise of the forest changed pitch, dropping to a minor key. In the buzz of the insects, there was even the hint of a scream. The Katuru moved on, her gown trailing through fallen leaves. She had a long day ahead of her, even with creatures coming to her of their own accord. It took time to judge such a glut of life. She worked methodically, drawn to the fire that burned inside each as yet unjudged species. There would be no escape. All would be judged. The holy work would be done. Overhead, bright eyes monitored her progress through the life on the ground. The eyes were large and round and amber, adapted by evolution to make the best of the gloom under the forest canopy. The colour of the eyes was reflected in the wetness of a glistening snout. The head was small and round and comical, but the creatures were sinuous and strong, hanging from branches by the pincer-like hands at the ends of five of their six arms. The sixth arm of each individual ended in a tightly gripped fist tucked close against the body, the muscles tense. But the other arms, holding them lodged in the branches, were relaxed and easy. They could hang eerily still for hours, as if fused with the trees. One of these creatures idly raked slender fingers through the fur of its neighbour, the oil in the skin of its fingertips unravelling the tangles. Another clicked and whistled, offering idle commentary on the robed woman below, the other creatures nodding along. For them, this languid observation was the height of anxiety. Their chatter disturbed the Katuru woman from her serious work. She stopped, stood up straight, and turned her veiled head just a fraction to look up into the branches. The effect was quite chilling, but it didn't silence the creatures. They clicked and whistled all the more, sharing alarm and drama. With withering disdain, the Katuru woman assessed them, peering into their lives, their legacy, their value. These lazy creatures did not have a name for themselves beyond a sequence of clicks that signified us in distinction to them, which did not always differentiate them from the trees, let alone other species. In millennia to come, when the Galactic Empire reached the planet Alexis, surveyors would name them after the disdainful chewing then yawning display made by some of the elders when the young misbehaved. Only a few of the elders performed this chewing then yawning, and it was only rarely performed again. But the name bound to the species ever after. They were the Mungellos. As if responding to this analysis, one of the creatures released its grip on the branch and tumbled abruptly to the ground. At almost the last moment, it performed a graceful somersault and landed on its hind legs. It didn't look comfortable on the ground. Evolution had perfected this species for life among the branches. On the forest floor, it looked crooked, bent. Until the Keturah woman realized the creature was making a display of subservience. She approached it, inhaling the sweet, complex stink of hormones that the species used to communicate feelings and social status. As she came close, the Mangello extended its sixth arm, the one creatures usually held close to their chest. Short, strong fingers opened to reveal, to proffer, a tiny scarlet jewel. Countless other species had tried to bribe their way out of judgment. The Keturah were not so pliable. But that wasn't what this was. The creature didn't understand what the Keturah woman was, or what she was here to do. It had simply come down from the relative safety of the branches to welcome her, and to present a gift.
"A most intriguing species," said the man in black velvet.
The woman didn't flinch, but incredibly, she hadn't known he was there. He'd been watching her from behind a tree, not hiding, not showing any fear, but with mild curiosity. Now he moved with easy, cat-like grace over to the Mangello and stroked its forehead. The Mangello purred, nuzzling into him and withdrawing its offer of the scarlet jewel from the Keturah woman. It tucked away its sixth arm protectively.
"It's all right," the man told the creature softly. "You have nothing to fear. Now..."
He withdrew from the creature, and it mewled at him, sadly, wanting more attention. He tutted, fondly.
"Maybe later," he said. "If you go back up where it's safe."
The creature sighed, then extended its long, lithe limbs and hauled itself into the branches. More arms reached down from the higher branches to assist and embrace it. There was soon an amiable tangle of sinuous, hairy bodies, bright eyes cast downward to watch what happened next. The man stepped out of the shadows, dusting his velvet-gloved fingers. In the dappled light, he looked a little less immaculate. The velvet suit had once been plush, but now looked threadbare. A long tear in one elbow, meticulously stitched. There was something about the man as well. His body had worn thin, and yet, like an old cat, he retained, he clutched hold of, his dignity.
"I take it,"
he said agreeably, eyes now on the woman,
"that I have the pleasure of addressing the due representative of the all-hallowed Keturah. I am your humble servant."
He bowed, though there was something playful, insincere in his movement. Did he dare to mock her? She looked inside his head. The man had been on the planet Alexis for years. He'd lost his timeship. No, he'd had it taken from him. His own people had cast judgment.
"I have nothing to hide,"
the master told her, with just a touch of psychic resistance, to show he was capable of it, but chose not to fight her.
"You find me in somewhat diminished circumstances, but I am eager to serve, I assure you. I am no threat."
That made her laugh, a wry croak of contempt at the very idea that he could in any way harm her. He smiled back at her, evidently pleased that he'd made this connection. She idly reached out a hand to the nearest tree trunk. The species of tree had already been judged, but the bright layer of moss was its own distinct organism. With malice, she doomed the moss to outlive the trees on which it depended. The master's smile faltered. He clearly understood what she had just done. It awed and appalled him, but he recovered his composure.
"It's always so satisfying," he said silkily, "to watch a professional at work. Pray continue."
The Keturu woman smarted at his condescension. She had already started to move her fingers down the mossy bark in pursuit of a beetle-like insect. In the instant she touched it, she allowed its developmental stages from instar to pupa to be dictated by the environment, which might mean it lived for decades. The adult stage, she capped at a year.
"It's akin to poetry," mused the master,
stroking a gloved thumb and forefinger over his beard in an effort to hide his disquiet.
"The length of journey might vary, but the time at destination remains the same. Distinctly firm but fair, if I may say so, miss."
She didn't respond. She was implacable. He smiled, apologetically.
"It's much more agreeable with names, but as you wish."
The Keturu woman now came suddenly forward. He tried to play it cool, but couldn't hide his fear. She came so close that she knew he could see something through her veil. The pronounced contours of her cheekbones. Her eyes remained shadowed, invisible. He did his best to hold her gaze. As he did, she reached up two purple fingers to probe his face.
"My people have an arrangement with death," he told her, his voice wavering. "You might say we've already been judged. Yes, you can sense it, can't you? And you're disappointed, my dear lady. Perhaps I might offer some recompense."
The Keturu woman traced her dry, cold fingers over his jawline to the stiff, high collar of his jacket, the material frayed and exposing his throat. He didn't resist as she prodded his neck even harder, but she could see she was causing him pain. A tear traced a line down his face.
"For example,"
he said, trying to keep his tone level and courteous,
"there are the Mongellos. They are placid to the point of indolence. They are intelligent and able, and yet utterly torpid. They are going nowhere as a species."
She pressed a little harder into the soft flesh of his throat until she felt the quickening pulse of his hearts. This close, she could delineate his senses and almost trace his thoughts. The master could feel her intruding inside his head, but couldn't stop her. He stifled a gulp and endeavored to maintain his smile.
"Nevertheless," he told her, "I intend to save them from you."
She heard her own laughter as he perceived it. An unnerving, tingling wrongness. The master had never liked being laughed at. She saw through him completely, this fragile little man.
"We are not accustomed to challenge," she told him,
stepping back to let him breathe.
"Those who know what we are and of what we are capable, they do not dare."
"Oh, my dear lady, I don't seek to contradict you,"
smiled the master. He knew she could easily strike him down, but he continued to push her.
"A hasty judgment here would be a sad mistake. These creatures are more than they appear. Due to unfortunate circumstance, I have been on this planet a long time. Yet that has allowed me the opportunity to observe them closely. If I might be so bold, there is nothing to be lost in heeding what I have learned about them. and I flatter myself that I might be of value, if you can take a longer view.
She considered. He'd taken an extraordinary risk in confronting her. Yet what did this disheveled, disgraced man have to lose? She saw in his past the schemes and ambitions that had all been thwarted. Now he hoped to be not useful, no, significant, as an advocate for these creatures. He had created himself a role. It was something to do after long years of nothing at all. So she indulged him, let him speak. Perhaps he could be of service. If not, she could crush him. The master gestured up into the branches.
My humble suggestion is that you try a slight shift in perspective, he said. Imagine the life of these creatures as they understand it themselves. They're docile, but don't mistake them for being slow. These are conscious, intelligent beings with a complex social interplay. In so many species, status is awarded on the basis of size and strength, or through negotiations of assessment by peers such as gossip. But here, there's no competition. It's more like idle pastime. They commune and amuse one another. They share observations of the world around them. They do not intrude.
They make no mark on their environment,
said the Keturah woman.
If the whole species died today, they would leave no trace that they had ever existed.
Indeed, indeed, said the master. And to these creatures that is considered great virtue.
Perhaps you think we should follow their example and judge other species by the length and depth of the footprint that they leave behind them. Your own people, for instance.
She curled her hand towards him. And this time he stepped quickly back. Beneath her veil, she grinned. But he didn't know she'd been teasing.
Many species,
she told him,
make no mark on their environment. What makes these creatures any different?
Their conscious choice, said the master. Their minimal impact on the ecosystem around them is a decision, a creed based on profound respect for life. As I said, they're intelligent, contemplative beings. Examine them and you'll find they have highly evolved brains and senses. Although they seem passive, they have a rich and complex sensory experience.
She could see it. Now he had pointed the way. She could see the density of feeling and texture in the world as perceived by the Mongellos. The dappling of sunlight, the perfume of pollen and spores, the changing taste and temperature of the air. All of it, a vibrant fizz of information, a feast for the senses. Yes, the Keturah woman could admit to herself she would have missed this aspect of their lives had the man not dared to confront her.
They consume the sensations around them,
she said. He beamed at her.
But,
she went on,
why would that justify special treatment?
The master didn't falter.
There's more to it than their sensations, he told her. Take the red jewel you were offered when you arrived here.
That could be constituted as a bribe,
she warned him.
Yes, 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 agreed the master. If you didn't understand the context, if you will indulge me.
Very well,
she said, unsettled to admit that yes, she was intrigued.
The Mongellos forage stones from the undergrowth here, said the master.
He crouched, running a hand through the litter on the forest floor, turning up bugs and twigs and soil. From just beneath the surface, he raked small, dark lumps. He selected a few and rubbed them lightly against his sleeve, scrubbing off mud and shining their smooth edges.
It's something like anthracite, with very few impurities and a high density of carbon, Another intelligent species might exploit this for fuel. But the Mungellos are drawn to its sensory properties, its feel and luster and smell. They can spend years foraging through the undergrowth to find exactly the right stone, and then they hold on to it tightly. He stood, shining the dark stones against his sleeve. But now, looking upwards into the branches where the Mungellos sprawled, the Katuru woman followed his gaze, but already knew what she would see. Each creature's sixth arm was tucked up close to its body, cradling a treasure.
"This is what they start with,"
said the master, holding out four stones he'd polished against his sleeve. They were blue-black, the facets smooth and bright.
"Attractive, in their own way,"
mused the master.
"They could be used to fashion ornaments or jewelry. But the Mungellos simply hold them. Their sixth arm has evolved to the purpose. And it's not because the stones are precious, at least not at first. It is what the Mungellos do to them that makes them so remarkable."
The Katuru woman stared into the cool dark of the stones.
"The one I was offered was scarlet,"
she said.
"Yes, yes,"
said the master.
"And of completely different chemical composition."
"You mean a different type of stone?"
"Precisely, exactly that. And yet they were once exactly the same. The Mungellos take stones like the ones in my hand and transform them. It's a quite remarkable process. Partly it's the pressure they apply to the stone in that specially evolved sixth hand. Then there's the oily sweat and the pheromones they secrete through their skin. Then there's the length of time involved. They can grip the same stone for 1,000 years. Or they'll trade them with one another, so that many hands might grip the same stone over time, each one changing its properties. But the longer a stone is gripped, the more extraordinary it becomes. In colour, in chemical composition, in the wonder of its effect, the result is that each jewel is absolutely unique."
"And thus valuable,"
said the Katuru woman.
No, not at all. Indeed, from our perspective, that might be the most remarkable thing. The Mungellos understand the time and effort involved in producing these unique properties. And yet when you arrived here, one slunk down from the trees to offer you such a jewel freely. It was not a bribe, but a welcome. They would offer the same to anyone who came here, as they did when I first arrived here, and on occasion since. They trade them amongst themselves freely, but with some kind of reciprocation that I'm still trying to understand. It involves testing and assessing levels of trust. But they clearly use these stones to make social bonds, to bring everyone closer together."
"It is a means of conversation,"
said the woman.
"Oh, I think it's rather more than that. They recognize something of what you are and what you are doing here. And even so, their response was to reach out in a gesture of welcome. You can ignore or rebuke that gesture, but then that would say more about you than it does about them."
"You mean a moral debt has been placed upon me?"
"One that you would have to live with for the rest of your life. And how long is that?"
The woman smiled, for all the veil concealed it. Oh, he was a sly one, this master. But she rather admired his audacity.
"The Mungellos have enchanted you,"
she said.
"Yes, yes,"
said the master.
"They are completely selfless. I couldn't believe it at first. I wanted to study and test them and prove it somehow wrong, but they're everything that they seem. I find that quite beguiling."
He took a deep breath.
"I find it worth defending."
So that was it. The challenge. She could taste what it had cost him. His hearts were beating fast.
He twitched with apprehension. This man who was so often so still. She savored his anxiety. She delighted in it. Then she put her question.
Are they worth your own life?
Oh, the frisson that ran through him. It was delicious. But he tried to hide it, to put it behind him. He stood up straighter, proud.
If you think that necessary, then so be it.
The woman brooded. She would have paused anyway. It was always more effective, more dramatic, to make a supplicant wait. But she also resented his show of courage. She wanted his unadorned fear. She had seen through this man, knew his craven desires and failures. He surely couldn't maintain this new pretense for very long. Yet he gazed back at her, smugly. Suddenly she struck, grabbing him once more, but this time savagely. He yelped, tried to pull away, but with little effort on her part, she forced him to his knees. Other intelligent life forms would thrash and bite as she subdued them. But the master overcame his instincts. She could sense the quick scheming inside his head, gambling that this was how he'd most impress her and so preserve his life. Then there was movement in the branches overhead. She assumed the creatures were going to attack and was ready to strike them all down once she'd dealt with the master. But no. A lone Mongello dropped languidly to the forest floor, a little distance away. It sprawled and yawned, as if it wasn't even aware of her or the man she had just subjugated. This wasn't the same Mongello as before, but an older, greyer figure, with a sorrowful countenance. It now affected to notice her, and sauntered casually over to see what she was up to. Yet when this respected elder proffered its sixth arm, it was not to the Keturah woman, but to the master. The jewel it held out gleamed silver white. The master remained in the Keturah woman's grip and couldn't turn his head to see. With a sigh, she released him. He fell back, hacking and coughing, clutching at his neck. But now he saw the Mongello and the proffered jewel.
It's a token of gratitude,
the woman told him.
It would be ill-mannered to refuse.
The master nodded, mutely, and reached out one gloved hand to delicately pick up the jewel. The Mongello bowed respectfully and stepped back.
Thank you,
said the master hoarsely.
They must think you made a good argument on their behalf,
said the woman.
They have paid you well.
The master glared up at her.
I didn't do this to be paid.
She smiled.
But that jewel is valuable. I see what it kindles inside you.
That is not the point. It's a token of their esteem. Even though I failed to convince you. How could I not be moved by that? So yes, yes, this jewel means a great deal. To me. It's not worth anything otherwise.
He faltered, because the ancient Mongello was glowering at him.
I don't mean any offense, said the master quickly. It is valuable, but not outside this immediate context. I mean, one day there'll be some modest, almost negligible interest among collectors, but this kindness hasn't made me rich or...
He stopped, because the Mongello had started to growl. It bared its teeth and glared down at the master and the jewel it had given away, which now glowed silver blue. The master shuffled backwards from the angry beast, and the jewel shone brighter blue. The Keturah woman delved into it to understand why.
"This stone has unique properties,"
she told the master.
"It is sensitive to truth."
"I speak the truth," said the master, getting unsteadily to his feet. He held up the jewel to speak to it directly.
"I would not lie to you. I am your friend, your protector."
But it became sky blue. Mangello growled more fiercely. Its anger echoed from the branches above.
"The stones create more than social bonds,"
said the woman, fascinated.
"They produce a psychic connection, which you already knew."
"No, no,"
whispered the master, trying to resist her as she reached into his mind.
"No."
"I think,"
said the Keturah,
"we can increase the effect."
The master could not escape the all-encompassing blue. 3 million years in the future, a fleet of Vendrovian death ships broke out of hyperspace to hang in the stratosphere of the dwarf moon Sparrow. A single ship contained enough firepower to obliterate the moon, or sterilize all life on its surface. But every ship in the fleet now trained its full arsenal on a small district in the Eastern Hemisphere, on one particular nation-state, a town, the castle there, the main courtyard, a podium, the man in velvet.
"Ah."
He smiled wolfishly, toying with a jewel in his hand.
"Now that I have your attention..."
Then they were back in the forest, the master shaken and perspiring as he dropped the dull blue stone. It lay, slightly steaming, in the soil of the forest floor. The elder Mangello leaned over to spit on it, and the stone turned black, like the raw pieces that the master had foraged earlier.
"How long have you known what the stones could do?"
the Keturah woman asked him.
"I didn't,"
said the master, but the Mangello growled at him.
I wasn't sure," he admitted. "But I tested the stones that they gave me when I arrived here. And there seemed to be the potential, if they're squeezed for long enough, if the chemical transformation is right. Perhaps a handful of these stones could be used to stabilize high-energy weaponry. A clutch of them, and you could change the course of an interplanetary war."
He turned to the Mangello.
"I could use that power to prevent conflict. Bring peace."
But the creature turned away from him. It shuffled over to the Keturah woman and extended its sixth arm. The hand was empty. But the woman understood what the creature intended.
"Are you sure?"
she asked the elder. It simply bowed its head. The master was truly horrified.
"No!"
he protested.
"You can't do this. You don't understand what it will mean."
He grabbed the Mangello by one of its other arms.
"It's not just you. It's the rest of them. Even your children. It's all of you forever after. You can't be, you mustn't be, so selfish."
But the elder Mangello swatted him away. The Keturah woman looked up to the other Mangellos, watching from the branches above.
"Do you all understand what this means?"
she asked them. They blinked back at her dolefully. So she took the elder's hand. In that moment, the Mangellos were limited to lives of just a few years. They retained their rich senses, their empathy, their connection to each other and the world around them. The new limit on their lives made their experience all the more vivid and profound. but they also couldn't afford to sprawl idly in the branches. They became more active as a species and abandoned their precious stones. In generations to come, their descendants would no longer amuse the surveyors of the Galactic Empire, who would classify the species with a number instead of a name. In enacting judgment, the Katuru woman effectively made the Mungellos cease to exist. There was something else now, something less, in a way. And yet, the Katuru woman could feel the creature's own feelings. She knew that they were satisfied by what they had done. While it left the master haunted,